greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and delighted to have Ted Bardicke join us today. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Clean Power Alliance. It's the largest community choice aggregator in the United States. I've known Ted for many years and look forward to talking to him about how CCAs can enhance our sustainable energy future. Hey, Ted, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Great. I'm doing great. Good to see you, Ted.
Good to see you, too. Hey, you've been at the helm of Clean Power Alliance for now for 5 years. How's it going?
Well, it's going really well. We've become the largest community choice aggregator in the state of California, a very large player in the Western energy markets. And, one of the exciting things is we now have more customers getting 100% renewable energy than any utility in the nation. So, it's nice to be big, but just being big isn't enough. It's what you do with that size and scale. And we're pretty excited about what we've been doing.
Now, is there a larger CCA in the United States? I thought maybe we were the largest in the country still.
Yeah, probably. I'm still focused on California and in what we're doing, but you're probably right.
I would imagine. And for the sake of our listeners, how do you frame up the benefits of community? What a clunky term that is, community choice aggregator.
Well, yes, it's a clunky term, but it actually describes what we're all about. So we are about community. And, even though we're a large energy supplier, we do many things that are for and reflect the values of the communities that we serve. So that's the sort of the community part. And that can range from, just basically responsive we are to customers, or, how we design our programs, very much with the community in mind, or, some of the qualitative values that we bring to our procurement practices. Things like, a big emphasis on workforce development and training the workforce of the future for the green economy, or how we site our large projects that are out in the desert to make sure that we are minimizing the environmental impact of our new energy, renewable energy facilities, really bringing an environmental justice and focus to how we do both our projects and our procurement. Things that are qualitative values in addition to price and portfolio fit that are really about what the values of the communities that we serve. So that's the community focus. The choice is what we're offering. We're offering a choice where choice didn't exist. And, previously if you were in one of our communities, you got what they gave you, and what they gave you was determined by the legislature and the San Francisco Public Utilities, the Public Utilities Commission in San Francisco, and a monopoly provider. And we think that choice is good. Competition is good. Competition breeds innovation. It gets people to sharpen their pencils. It pushes you to try new things, and so we're offering that choice. And then the aggregator part is bringing if you're a community on its own, it's hard to sort of bring the scale that you need to make these positive systemic impacts. And so we're aggregating the purchasing power across, in our case, 32 communities, soon to be 35, and aggregating that power is important. It's important for market perspectives. It's important for political leverage, and it's important for here in Southern California for bringing a shared Southern California perspective to the energy markets.
Really well put. I'm not surprised, Ted, you're the right guy for the job. But I thought you were going to say basically we bring renewables faster and cheaper to the market. Here's our I mean, it seemed like that was the original claim for CCAs that instead of the investor-owned utilities, which as you described it, are regulated and move rather slowly, a CCA could bring renewables quickly to the market and at the same price or even less cost because you don't have to pay shareholders. But I really like what you talked about. You've really gotten into this community aspect of developing programs. We'll talk about workforce development, environmental justice. It's taken a much broader focus.
Well, I think, started there because, that's, I think we're not always going to be cheaper. Usually we're cheaper. Right now we're cheaper. But I can't always promise that. So I don't like to lead with, with what we'll always be competitive. But I do think that and the point about the community values is, yes, the part of the community values is we'd like to bring renewables quicker into the market, and we are doing that. I think the conceptual way that I would describe it is, the regulated utility generally has a view that the compliance is the ceiling. We hit our compliance, and that's what we do. And here at Clean Power Alliance, we view compliance as the floor. So we will comply, but then we want to try to beat that because generally compliance is kind of the lowest common denominator, and we want to be, higher and push harder and faster.
And you're succeeding, right? I mean, customers could opt out of Clean Power Alliance, right? And I know in Santa Monica, you've got tremendous retention there. And is that true of most of your member cities that most people are sticking with CPA?
Yeah, so we have about across our service territory of 1 million plus customers, we have a 93% participation rate. So 93% of the customers who can participate in Clean Power Alliance do. And that number has been steady for the past 3 or 4 years.
That's awesome.
So it's a pretty stable customer base. Clearly, people believe in the value proposition and like what we're selling.
That's great. Let's go about all the way back in your life and talk about sort of what prepared you for this position. Born and raised somewhere on the East Coast, right, Ted?
No, I was born in Berkeley and raised in Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco. So a Bay Area boy. A son of two, my parents both went to Berkeley in the 60s. So they were pretty far left. And I sort of was raised with some of those values in the household.
Right. And then off you went to the East Coast for college, right?
That's right. And then
Wesleyan.
I left. I graduated high school when I was 16. I skipped eighth grade, and therefore graduated pretty young. Took a gap year and interned for a senator in Washington, D.C., who was on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee way back when, and then went to college. Took 5 years to graduate because I was, doing fun stuff.
Well, and it sounded like Spanish, studying Spanish in Mexico became part of your interest back then.
Well, so part of growing up, my father in the early 70s moved to the Salinas Valley and the Pajaro Valley and settled in Watsonville. And worked a lot in and around the agricultural community in that area. And so I grew up with a lot of Spanish and Mexican influence in my childhood. And then spent some time working with the Quakers in Mexico doing development projects while I was in college, and doing some service work. And so by the time I graduated from college, I was fluent in Spanish, and then moved within 6 months of graduating, moved back to Mexico City.
And that was to be a correspondent, right?
Yeah. So I moved to Mexico City, and it's an interesting tale. I kind of had two job paths that I potentially could follow. One was doing sort of NGO development work for Oxfam. And the other was to move into journalism, or, you know, be more of a writer and participate that way. And, you know, the stars aligned for the journalism bit. And over the course of 5 years of being a journalist in Mexico City, really starting at the bottom, by the time I left, I was the correspondent for the Financial Times of Mexico, Financial Times of London, based in Mexico, spent time in Central America for them, spent some time in Haiti for them, and then got an offer from the FT to move to Bangkok in 1995, which I did.
And you were there for, I think, another five, six,
another 5 years, and did my tour of Southeast Asia for 5 years for the Financial Times in based in Bangkok, but covering all of Southeast Asia, and you know, right up until 2000.
Oh, that must have been absolutely fascinating. This was after grad school at Columbia?
No, this was before. So, living for 10 years in Mexico City and in Bangkok for basically the entire 1990s taught me a lot about cities.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, taught me a lot about good food, too. You know, Thai food and Mexican food, two of the world's great cuisines.
Uh-huh.
But it taught me a lot about cities and their place in sort of global development, their place in providing quality of life or lack thereof, their incredible suck on their surrounding natural resources, how, you know, big international cities are keyed into the global economy, and with, big implications for international finance and capital markets. So I was faced at that time of having been out of the country for more than a decade, and, you know, was I going to continue along the journalism path or want to continue to look at cities and the environment in particular? Also, I had been really interested, in both Mexico and Thailand, you know, about how the energy markets and the energy development worked, with whether it was, you know, Pemex in Mexico, or, you know, proposals to build, you know, eight big dams across Laos and flood communities to power, you know, global development. It was just interesting to me.
Yeah.
And so I did decide to go back to school and get an urban planning degree at the Columbia School of Architecture.
Fantastic. And then is it right after that you went to Global Green? Is that?
Yeah. So I spent a year in New York doing some development work and some work in green building. And in 2003 moved to Santa Monica to join, what was a small fledgling nonprofit at that point, to work mostly with cities and affordable housing developers to green their projects and their policies. And together with you know, our mutual friends, Matt Peterson and Walker Wells, really developed what was called the Green Urbanism Program at Global Green, and you know, was spent 10 years there doing that.
That's great. And then Matt went on to being the first sustainability officer for the city of Los Angeles, and you went and was his deputy, I think, originally.
I was his deputy for about 18 months, and then moved within the mayor's office to, after the first sustainability plan came out, to be director of infrastructure, which I did for about 3.5 years. So director of infrastructure in the mayor's office, which had me working a lot with Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and the five bureaus of the Public Works Department.
What would you say was the most rewarding part of that experience, being in the infrastructure role?
Yeah, I think from you know, the first part of the Garcetti administration from 2013 to 2017, and I left in early 2018, was very much about back to basics and you know, providing good constituent services, good infrastructure services, you know, filling potholes and stuff like that. And we faced the 2015 drought during that time. And what I really think, broadly speaking, was the ability to take some sustainability things, whether that was in renewable energy or in the water side or in the public service, you know, in general public works, and sort of imbue sustainability features and values and metrics and into the basic functioning of the city, and not have it be so much an add-on or a screw-on, but embedded into everything we were doing.
Sounds like that's the most rewarding thing and probably the most challenging thing too.
Oh yeah, and there were wins and losses along the way.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, when you're working in local government, or that to the extent that sustainability is something that's bolted on externally, means that it can be unscrewed and unbolted. and taken off. And I think you got to kind of make it from the base and part of that structure rather than as an add-on. And, you know, again, I think there were parts of what we were able to do there that were successful at.
That's great. And then Gary Giroux, another mutual friend of ours, was working for the county, Los Angeles County, and he put together what became Clean Power Alliance. And you were recruited or applied for the position, and it must have been a little bit daunting, I was thinking, Ted.
I didn't quite at the time know, frankly, what I was getting into.
Yeah.
I think it dawned on me that maybe at my first board meeting, when it was 31 board members and me, and Gary, of course, who was heavily involved in the formation and helped us, you know, helped a lot in those early days. And there were a number of consultants on board, but being the first employee with a $10 million loan from the county and some consultants and some county staff helping out, is kind of when it dawned on me that I had to, you know, first and foremost, A, win the trust of the board, and B, you know, build a team that was gonna, you know, able to be successful. And so I think, you know, the two lessons that I took away from that, the first with the board is to just be open and honest and not sugarcoat things and not pull punches when things were going wrong, and, you know, just give it to them straight. Yep. And, you know, celebrate the victories and thank people for the support, but also just, you know, not hold back. And I think, you know, their trust was earned over time because, you know, I was pretty straightforward with them. And then the other thing is to build a team. We have over 60 people who work at Clean Power Alliance. And, you know, the people who are now the chief administrative officer, the chief operating officer, the chief financial officer, and the general counsel were all people who I recruited in the first 12 months, really in the first 9 months of starting. And they're all still with the organization. And so building that team and keeping that team was really, really, really important. And we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing today without that. Not only the high quality people, but being able to keep them excited, keep them engaged, keep them, you know, keep us all rowing in the same direction.
Right. And it would seem that in order for your success, like you said early off, you may not always be the cheapest, you'd be competitive, but it seems like for your success, you need people that really understand how to purchase power out on the market, right? Did you bring in people that had, you know, significant experience to do that?
Oh, and way more experience than I did. You know, I think I was hired here to, because, you know, I knew enough about everything we were going to do. And I knew how to interact with a board of local elected officials. Yeah. And find the right balance between what the board needs to do and what staff needs to do. But many of the technical things that we're doing were being handled by consultants in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I felt like part of my job was to build an institution. Right. If we're going to be the largest, you know, CCA in the state, now the third largest load serving entity in the CAISO, you know, a major player in energy markets, we couldn't do that with a consultant based system for our core operations. So part of what I was selling the technical people on to come join us is, you know, be part of this exciting thing, this new journey, this, you know, startup excitement, but also feel like you're building an institution that's going to have a 5-year anniversary and a 10-year anniversary and a 25-year anniversary, and you know, that our kids and our grandkids will be able to point and say, you know, my dad or my grandfather or my grandmother or mother or aunt or uncle did that.
Yeah, how great. And this team obviously has to go out on the market. I guess I'm more fixated on buying resources, which I think would be very challenging. But you're buying long-term resources, you're buying short-term resources. I had Karen Burns, who's the CEO of San Diego Community Power, on the podcast a few months ago. And she said, yeah, that's a really big part of the name of the game. I was asking her, how can you afford to run all these programs, these community-based programs and resiliency programs that you and I are involved with? How can you afford to do all these programs and keep your prices competitive or below, in that case, San Diego Gas and Electric, in your case, Edison? It seems as though, and what she emphasized was, Ted, if you buy properly or if you buy competitively, then you have the resources to be able to provide all these other benefits in the community. Is that your take on it also? I worry when I see the CCAs sort of trying to do too much, and I'm worried that they'll lose their competitive edge.
Yeah. So I think rather than sort of the buying the mechanics of the buying bit, which there are plenty of people who can do. What we're really in the business of is managing risk. And we face all kinds of risks. We face the risks of you know, sort of the market risk of commodity. We're involved in electricity as a commodity. It's impacted by weather, by economic conditions, by regulation, by many things we can't control. And so you have to manage that risk. We also have to manage the risk, as you mentioned. People can opt out. We're a competitive market. People can leave us, and we make long-term purchase commitments to buy energy at certain prices, and our customers can opt out anytime. And so we face that opt-out risk. And then, you know, we face regulatory and political risk. And so I think the way we can stay competitive and generate the resources that we need to offer programs and to do innovative things is really by managing risk well. Mm-hmm. And we have lots of tools, and we have lots of people in-house who do that every day. And we tend to be more conservative in our risk management than many others in the market. And so far, that's paid dividends. But being conservative means essentially the swings are not going to be great either on the downside or on the upside. Mm-hmm. And we have to just be in the business of being conservative in that way, and not trying to make big bets on swings in the market one way or another. That will be the downfall, is making big bets.
Yeah.
And it's always tempting, but I kind of say, if I knew how to bet on the market, I'd be making those bets from some yacht somewhere.
What's your vision then? You've got a fantastic retention rate. People are happy. You're adding programs. Is your vision to get bigger in terms of service? You mentioned you're adding a few more cities, but is your vision to get quite a bit bigger, or to stay at a certain size and just grow in terms of quality? Or
yeah, so there's several ways we can grow. We can grow by adding new cities, which brings us new eligible customers. And we'll be doing that in 2024, adding the cities of Hermosa Beach, Monrovia, and Santa Paula. It's about 35,000 customers. And we can continue to add new cities over time. It's a long process. And, you know, it takes 2 to 3 years at minimum to add a city. And we want to be very deliberate about that. And there are still, you know, a few dozen cities in Los Angeles County that would be eligible to join us. And I think we're, you know, so that we can maintain cohesive in terms of our community values. I think we're limited to Los Angeles and Ventura County. But there's a lot of sort of growth by adding new cities. So that's one way that we can grow. Another way we can grow is in terms of the amount of electricity we sell to our existing customers. And that's a function of how we can essentially get them to fuel switch from natural gas for their homes and gasoline for their cars. If they can power their homes with electricity and power their cars with electricity instead of those fossil fuels, our load will grow, and then we'll we will grow our sales and improve the environment along the way. So we have programs and policies in place to help grow the electricity share of the pie. You know, at the end of the day, people say, "Oh, you're really competing with Edison." Well, actually, Edison's an electricity utility also. Really, we're competing with the gas company and the gasoline refiners for market share of how people power their lives. So day to day, we're competing with Edison for our customers and on price, but the long-term competition is really the fossil fuel industry. And that's how we're going to grow, is by winning that battle.
Very interesting. Ted, just a couple of questions, just sort of wrapping up here. We could talk about a lot of your services, and maybe we'll do that in a subsequent interview. But you've been at this for 5 years. You seem cool, calm, and collected. How are you keeping a balance? How are you keeping all this potential, this pressure on you in perspective?
Well, I think there's a few ways. One is, you know, I really believe in the mission and the thing that our communities and our board wants us to do. And that's always very sustaining. If you can go back to that touch point of the mission. The second way is to, you know, really lean back on the team and the team that we've been able to build here. And it's so exciting to watch them take on new things and watch them flourish and feel like they're excited. That always makes me excited. And then, you know, people talk about the work-life balance and that stuff. You know, I've always worked really hard and have figured out with my family how to still be a present husband and a present dad while working really, really hard. So I think it's as much looking to like why I'm excited to continue to work hard rather than like trying to cut back the hours of the day. Yeah. And in that case, you know, again, you know, the mission, the team, and frankly, being intellectually engaged, I think, as you've probably seen from the conversation. And as you know me, I'm just interested in the way the world works. And the energy sector is just one of the most interesting things because everybody needs it, and it's down to, you know, someone turning on the lights all the way up to big global capital, and that's where I've been, you know, ever since I was a foreign correspondent and interested in the world and wanting to engage. So that's how I keep myself going.
Ted, thanks so much. Great talking to you today.
It's been a pleasure, Ted, and appreciate the partnership and the friendship that we've had over the course of a couple of decades now.
Likewise. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks. Bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.